remember. Old Marcus Garvey, no one remember. Old Marcus Garvey.
Hello. My guest today is the playwright Kwame Kweama, and he's been interested in our subject today since he first heard that song on the radio at the age of 19.
No one remember old Marcus Garvey. No one remember old Marcus Garvey.
That was Burning Spear. Kwame, tell us when you first heard that and the effect that it had on you.
This record was introduced to me by my cousin saying, you need to know who Marcus Garvey is. And at first, I was a bit like, okay. Yeah. And then I began to read about him and to understand that here was a man at the turn of the 20th century who was doing things that if Barack Obama did at the beginning of the 21st would seem magnificent. And I became quite enthralled by him.
Your parents were born in Grenada.
Grenada.
Would he have meant much to them?
No, not at all. It was a discovery of my own.
Kwame Kweama was artistic director of the Third World Festival of Black Arts and Culture, held last year in Dakar, Senegal. He's an associate artist of the National Theatre and is currently Chancellor of the University of the Arts in London. He's also just recorded the pilot for his first sitcom series, Rollin' with the Roberts. And we're joined by the historian Colin Grant, the author of Negro with a Hat, a book that illuminated the politics and personality of Marcus Garvey. Garvey also features in Colin's recently published I and I, The Natural Mystics, a group biography of the original Wailers. Colin, tell us where and when Marcus Garvey was born.
Marcus Garvey was born in Jamaica, St. Anne's Bay, in 1887. He grew up in poverty, really.
Of course, Jamaica was a British colony throughout Garvey's life. It's hard to remember what things were like then in Jamaica. I got there, my family lived there for 5 years, about 7 years after independence in 1962. Let's listen to Vivian Durham, a contemporary of Garvey's, talking on Radio 4 in 1987 in a programme to mark the centenary of Garvey's birth.
The ambition of every black Jamaican in those days was to be a white man. In those days, our conception was based upon the story of the rich man in his castle, the poor man at his gate. God made him high and lowly and hoarded their estate. Until we got universal adult suffrage in 1944, a black man could not be inspector of police. It would have been incredible to have a black man like me being a justice of the peace. And so those were the kind of rapacious conditions that Garvey came and led the mental revolt against.
Colin, your parents came from Jamaica. And you've spoken in the past of something you call a pigmentocracy. What do you mean by that?
Basically, the lighter you are, the better. Jamaica is a country full of black people, essentially. 90% of the people are black. But there's a elite, a brown elite and a white elite, which was put in place through colonialism. In a way, Garvey's great power was that he appeared and was, in a sense, an undiluted black man. He appealed to the poor, downtrodden black people. At a time, black people were denigrated. They were ashamed. They were at the footstool of society.
In came this rather round, rotund, dark-skinned black male who sounded, at the beginning of his career, like George III. And then, near the end, when he was in America, sounded like Roosevelt. What he was really brilliant at was saying that even though you look at me and you think that I'm at the bottom of the pile, I represent the best of Africa. I am an African. And all of you guys who want to assimilate to a European perception of beauty and intellect, well, actually, you're wrong.
But he was a strange figure in a way because, yes, he represented this new idea of Afrocentricity, of believing yourself to be at heart an African, but actually he was a man of empire. He was British and he loved being British and he sang the national anthem to the best of his ability and would be on a par with any great patriot.
Tell me a little bit about the man's character.
What intrigues me about Garvey is that he's a very modest man, actually. The public perception of him is this man with this big booming voice. His voice could be heard from several blocks away. It was said that he had a voice like God. He had a voice like thunder. And so he was a showman publicly. But privately, he was very modest. He wore cardigans with holes in his elbows. He ate cream crackers and cheese. He was very modest in his tastes.
But also, he was quite a shy man. His first speeches, I mean, he was almost booed off the stage and fell off the stage in embarrassment, was stuttering. This wasn't someone who was a natural-born orator.
And he'd had no formal education at all, had he?
He hadn't, but it's an interesting comment because he did eventually lead what was called the Universal Negro Improvement Association.
Correct.
And that word improvement is very key. Important. It's key because he started with himself. He took elocution lessons.
Yeah.
He recognised that he wanted to be this public speaker.
But maybe the most difficult and perhaps impossible question of all, Kwame. Here's an uneducated lad. Nothing to distinguish him, really, from hundreds of thousands of other such boys. From where did the ideas enter his head about African dignity and African self-improvement so that he suddenly starts making speeches and travelling the world?
I mean, he speaks about when he was on the ship back to Jamaica and he runs into this man who says the black man is catching hell from South Africa to the top of Africa. The black man is catching hell wherever you are. And where is our pride? If there's one thing that comes out of Garvey is that he's a very prideful man, is that his father has been shamed and he feels the shame of his father and he must educate himself. When he's a young man and he's the union leader, he's very proud that he's a young man in Kingston. You know, and there are men of 40 and 50 who are not doing what he's doing.
How was this extraordinary young man received, firstly, by other Africans and secondly, by the whites?
Well, he left Jamaica in 1916, eventually to go to Harlem in New York. And this was a time of the birth of what was called the Ebony Orators. These are street speakers. And Garvey was given a chance to, and when he spoke, people were enthralled by the wonderful dulcet tones, but also the fact that he spoke with passion and real heart. And so slowly he built up a kind of following, and soon thousands of people were coming to hear him.
And he has by now started the Universal Negro Improvement and Conservation Society, it was originally called.
Yes, he has. But I also think it's fair to say that as much as he attracted fans, he also attracted enemies.
Mm.
Because, again, the kind of African-American elite of that day, as he was elevated, almost saw him as an upstart.
Mm.
Here is this man upsetting not only the blackocracy, but upsetting our kind of white patrons as well. He's not an educated man in the way that Du Bois was. And so that hurts him, and I think is a huge motivating factor, that he will not only uplift black people, but he'll show his detractors that they are wrong, and not only that they're wrong, but they're part of the problem and not the solution.
Because he was very critical of black people themselves. Listen to Amy Bailey, a follower of his, in the very early days.
I followed him in Jamaica, wherever he went to, and I saw how he was teaching his people, and he would tell them what no white man could tell them. With impunity, he would say to them, "You say that you are as good as a white man, but you can't be as good as a white man unless you keep yourselves clean. It doesn't matter whether you have only one shirt and one pant. Wash them. You can get penny soap. The sun doesn't charge you for drying them. And if you do that, you will earn the respect of the white man." He would tell him another thing. He says, the black man has it very hard because there's something about us that we don't cling to each other. We hate each other. Why do we hate each other? Learn to love each other. Learn to respect each other before you can demand it of the other man.
That's right at the core of his philosophy of self-determination, which is that you're as hard on yourself as you are on the enemy, as it were, quote-unquote.
And he recognised that the problem that black people had at the beginning of the 20th century was a problem of presentation, of being perceived as being less than human. And he wanted to show black people themselves and white people that black people were just as capable as being civilised, as being erudite, as being noble and as proud as anybody else.
As you've said, Colin, when he arrived in Harlem, he quickly became popular for his street corner oration. Let's listen to some rather crackly archive of Garvey himself speaking in 1921, one of the only two known recordings of his voice.
Muslims of Africa, I greet you in the name of the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League of the World. If you believe that the Negro has a soul, if you believe that the Negro is a man, then you must acknowledge that whatever men have done, Negroes can do.
It's almost enhanced by the crackling because it reminds us, and we've got to remember this, this is 1921.
Correct.
I think it's amazing, actually, if you listen to that voice, you hear the passion in that voice, but also you hear the grandiosity.
Yes.
And you hear, actually, the huge sense of his own worth. This is a man, just before that recording, proclaimed himself to be the provisional president of Africa.
Correct.
Which is a rather grand statement, is it not? But actually...
Bearing in mind that he hadn't got there.
He hadn't got there yet, and would never get there, sadly. But also, and he looked to the Irish, he looked to Sinn Féin,
yeah.
And de Valera had proclaimed himself to be the provisional president of Ireland.
Correct.
Garvey went one step further.
By the early 1920s, in fact, membership of the Universal Negro Improvement Association was estimated by Garvey in the millions, and Garveyism became a whole way of life. There were amazing parades in Harlem.
I remember on Sundays, the men walking with these uniforms and the sword. They had a sword on the sides, and they had these hats with the plume.
The Legion uniform was black with gold and diamond workings on the sleeves.
With the green or red shoulder epaulets with the buttons, oh, they were out of this world, stunning. And they put fear in the hearts of all who saw them.
That was Ram Ramirez, Abdul and Marion Samad, taken from the BBC archives. And you're listening to BBC Radio 4. I'm Matthew Paris, and my guest on Great Lives, Kwame Kweama, has chosen the life of Marcus Garvey. Colin Grant is our expert witness. Extraordinary thought, these parades.
These ceremonies, these parades frightened the FBI. They frightened Hoover. They frightened white America.
Well, not surprising.
Not surprising. But actually, they were ceremonial. The pins were taken out of the guns. The guns couldn't fire. They were just for show.
Is that right, Kwame? Where did he stand on violence, do you think?
For instance, when the Ku Klux Klan were at their height and they were just lynching black men like crazy, he would send units down, crack units down, and surround the prisons where black men had been held and say, if you walk in here, then you have to fight us. And that was part of the reason why people became afraid, because he wasn't advocating violence, but he certainly was advocating self-defense. And I think, you know, part of the other thing for me is these huge parades, marching down, hiring Madison Square Gardens.
Yeah.
It's magnificent.
Yes.
He believed in pomp and ceremony, and he knew that that cut right to the heart of the black psyche in the West at the time, that we wanted our armies, we wanted our generals, we wanted our presidents, we wanted someone who could speak with authority and that could speak in the way that the white man speaks, but speak on our terms. We craved that.
This is a time when there was a call for a black Moses to take the people out of exile and take them back to the promised land. And one of the Garvey's great ideas was this idea of repatriation, wasn't it, Kwame?
Well, yes, that actually this is how a people who are lost can once again be found.
But the problem was that there was no unity in this particular idea, because there were already these established brown elites in America,
yes,
and they thought the idea of going back to Africa was preposterous. And they would say that there was no way you were going to get someone to relocate from Harlem to Monrovia unless you were able to replicate Harlem in Monrovia.
I wanted to ask you, Kwame, about this. His idea of Africa being the spiritual homeland, the ancestral homeland, and quite possibly the destination of black peoples, I imagine was not shared much in Jamaica. I came to Jamaica from Africa and imagined that Jamaicans would be interested in hearing about Africa, and found they were really not very interested in hearing about Africa.
I mean, again, Matthew, you're absolutely right. One has to put it in context. The context is that when you were brought from Africa, as you know, to the Caribbean, at one point you could look 200 years that way and only know slavery, and look 200 years that way and only know slavery and colonialization. So actually you were deculturalized. And so all of a sudden to be saying to these beings who had been told that Africa was a land of savages and a land where people sold you, that actually to then somehow arise from that and say, no, Africa was this glorious place and you are an African. Actually, to articulate that went right to the very core of the miseducation of the black mind and the pain and the schism of associating yourself with somewhere that you'd been told had rejected you.
I don't think he ever envisages mass migration, though. He's pursuing American citizenship. He recognises that actually the core of his power is going to be in black America.
He wanted to buy acreages of land in Liberia to resettle those who wanted to go. And I think that's the key, those who wanted to go. It wasn't for everyone, but those who had the mindset to rebuild. And remember, he had a very colonial attitude to Africa. Here we would come, us blacks of the West, and we would civilize them, and we would bring industry, and we would somehow make it great. A very patronizing point of view for those intellectuals who had come from the motherland.
But I wonder whether his failure, I won't say disinclination, but his failure in the endeavour to go to Africa may unconsciously have arisen from the fact that he would have found it too challenging and too disappointing.
I
disagree as well. I disagree because I think he wanted to go to Africa.
Yes.
I think Garvey's great mistake was not to recognise the powers that were wielded against
yes.
him, because the British authorities were scared of him. They were petrified of him. Mm. The French were scared of him. Those two colonial powers were petrified that if his ideas took hold in Liberia, it would spread out into the continent. And so, again and again, he was denied a passport to travel.
It brings us to, I guess, an awkwardness about Garveyism, and that was, well, it's encapsulated in his slogan, race first, Africa for the Africans. There is a sort of racism.
Well, in the same way that again, Delaney was saying, Ireland for the Irish, in that he was talking about, and it's very easy with a 21st century lens to look on it as some kind of xenophobic, racist statement. I think he was simply saying at the time, Africa was owned by European powers from the top to the bottom. And actually, Africa should be owned by Africans.
But you know, even within American and Jamaican society, he tended to align himself with the completely black people against those people who wanted to mix.
But they were really attacking him. Sorry, Colin, I'll let you come in. they were really attacking him.
What was happening back then was that there were various factions and they wanted to build on their own power base. So the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Coloured People, was led by the kind of brown elite in America. They were in opposition to the Universal Negro Improvement Association. They even called them the ugliest Negroes in America.
He came out of that tradition of them saying, you are dark, you are black, you are nothing. That's his psychological environment. And actually, if there was a huge failing, is that what he didn't do was open up his organisation to the browntocracy. And that in a kind of way he thought, because you're dark, you'll see the world in the way that I will, and therefore I'll let you be close to me. And actually, some of them were not qualified to do the jobs that he wanted them to do. So it was a failing, but actually it was because he was pushed into that position. And some would say he should have then have transcended it.
I'm not sure that you completely fairly represent his position as a segregationalist, because the integrationalists, who included many wonderful and inspirational black leaders, suspected him. They didn't like him because they did believe that everybody could be together, and they felt that he was not on their side.
I think it's a false binary. We often associate a kind of assertion of community togetherness with a notion of racism and xenophobia.
It isn't with the Ku Klux Klan.
Well, you remember, he met the Ku Klux Klan. Mm. He actually went and said, look, I understand the notion of you wanting white power. I understand it, and I'm not even against it. And I understand you wanting it in your own land. I'm simply saying,
kind of apartheid.
Well, I don't know, because we keep thinking about separatism differently to Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad, which came later on. Garvey never quoted, as far as I'm concerned, I want an all-black world. I want an all-black Africa. I want an all-black community or an organisation. That was for later organisations. He never said that.
You said, Kwame, that because he so much wanted his movement to take root amongst black, completely black people, that he sometimes struggled to find people who had the experience to run the things he wanted to run, of which I think that the most famous is the Black Star Line, which he launched in 1919. It was the Black Star Line Steamship Corporation, its full name, and it was designed not just to take black people to Africa, but also to dominate world shipping.
It was a very ambitious project. When that first ship was bought, it was a thing to behold. I imagine at the time, amongst black people, it was akin to Barack Obama being made president. It was that huge, yes. Because he was saying with that purchase of the first ship, yes, we can.
He said, what we need to do is create trade. This is not about aid. This is not about asking the white man for favours. Let us create our own wealth. He's an arch capitalist. We often talk about his nationalistic tendencies, but actually, above all, he was an arch capitalist. He was creating scheme after scheme after scheme in order to make the organisation, and not himself, very important.
But his great achievement, which is the Black Star Line, was also the root of his failure.
Yes.
Because he had various businesses going on. Some were successful and some, like the shipping line, weren't. And all the money from the successful businesses were going into this bucket, this dark hole of Black Star Line. And the more he tried to buy ships, the more difficult it became to get the money in. So much so that he was actually, in the end, he was accused and went on trial for mail fraud. In essence, he was accused of soliciting shares for a ship that they hadn't yet bought.
But again, I don't want to sound like an apologist for Garvey.
I'm
challenged that a man at the beginning of the 20th century can do things that very few of us can do now.
But his mistake was not to rely on people who were competent.
He
was a great man of cutting the head
Colin,
of poppies.
Colin, that was, a huge flaw. But we mustn't underestimate that J. Edgar Hoover, of course, hired the first black FBI or Bureau agent at the time in order to bring him down. That in his organisation there were 10 or 20 spies set in there to bring him down.
After this comes the fall. The Black Star Line collapses. He's prosecuted on trumped-up charges in America. The president reprieves him. He returns to Jamaica. It isn't a happy return, is it?
He's a beaten man.
He
tries to start an organisation again, but he's a laughingstock. I mean, there are stories about when he landed, you know, children mocking him as he walked to his home.
But he was a beaten man in terms of the fact that he couldn't establish a political party because to vote in Jamaica at the time, you had to have either property or money, a certain amount of money and property. And so his natural constituents, the
couldn't
black
vote.
People, yes. had no opportunity to vote for
it's
him.
A real
so he was never going to take off.
To start a political party.
He had the will, he had the determination. People admired him, but they weren't able to vote for him.
In 1935, he moved to London and never returned to Jamaica. He was reduced to a spot at Speaker's Corner and became quite an isolated man. Amy Bailey visited him there.
He was sitting down in a chair like this. I said, tell me something. Why did you leave Jamaica? He said, I couldn't trust Jamaicans anymore, and so I came to my friends in London. I left the United States for my home in Jamaica, a man inspired to go on to liberate my people. I left Jamaica a broken man, and I will never, never, never go back to Jamaica.
He died in 1940 and was at first pretty much forgotten.
He was eclipsed, and the story of Garvey was told from the point of view of his enemies. His story was kept alive, though, by his wives, Amy Ashwood and Amy Jakes, and they published books, they spoke on his behalf, and the Rastafarians believed in him. But it came really to the independence of Jamaica from Britain in 1962 to recognise the importance of Garvey, because at that point now, there is a crisis of identity. You are no longer British. The British are gone. You're looking to the future. So you need to have some sort of symbol. You need to have some unifying figure. And it was the intelligence of Edward Ciaga, a minister in the government.
He was prime minister when I was there.
Right. Yeah. It was his intelligence to recognise that actually Garvey could serve as this great national hero. So they brought him back from London. They brought his remains back, and he was reburied in Jamaica in 64 and proclaimed the first national hero.
I've got to say that I came to this discussion as a Marcus Garvey skeptic. And I'll tell you why. it's because I found a lot of the people who idolised Marcus Garvey quite tiresome when I was younger. The loony left councils that named council estates after him. So I never really looked through all that to the Marcus Garvey himself, just as, you know, I'm prejudiced against Che Guevara because of the kind of people that had Che Guevara posters on their walls.
And T-shirts.
Yeah, yes. And he might have been a very interesting man. And you've persuaded me utterly of the greatness of the man and also how early he came to all this. So it's with a little hesitation that I end with perhaps the most difficult question. Was one of the reasons why he was a great man and why Marcus Garvey was able to inspire amongst African people a sense of pride in their own heritage and their own race, do we see in that also the seeds of the problems that have always beset African leadership, the cult of the great man, the tendency to strut, the tin ear for the voice that whispers, "Remember, you are mortal"? Is that an unfair question?
I mean, I think it's a great question. And I think the cult of personality is often more the fault of the people than of the personality himself. That as a community, as a nation, as a race, that we needed at that time a singular voice to articulate our needs in very clean and clear ways, in ways that didn't seem as if we were creeping to the white powers, in a way that didn't feel as if we were afraid of the white powers. Only one or two people are born in a generation that can do that, and that can do that from a position of love. I think that Garvey has been characterized as, in the past, by the authorities, as someone whose motivation was self-aggrandizement, when actually it was about the aggrandizement of the community to which he was born. So whereas I think it's a great question, I think that it is one that black leadership should continue to ask itself. And that I wished that someone had asked Garvey that, or that he'd listened to that kind of question earlier on in his career. And maybe it may not have ended in the way that it did. But thank God we're now here talking about his greatness.
My thanks to Kwame Kweyama, who chose the great life of Marcus Garvey, and to Garvey's biographer, Colin Grant. Goodbye.